Okay. So we are on doing Malbim HaMishle. We're on chapter 10, 20. Sorry. Chapter 20. And we are going to be talking a lot today about injustice and about human rulers versus God, and the justice with which, each of those categories can rule. So here we go. We're going to do verses 8 and 9 together. Okay, so we're on page 206. For those of you who are following along in the book, welcome, Aaron. Welcome, Cindy. Welcome, Nechama. Nice to see everybody here today. All right, 8. Melech Yoshev al Kisei Din, a king who sits on the throne of judgment. Mizareh ve'einav kol ra, scatters away all evil with his eyes. Okay, so the king who sits on his throne of judgment can scatter evil. He has the power, right, to reward the good and to punish evil, and therefore he has a very powerful ability to rid the world of evil by prosecuting evil. It's actually interesting to note that there are, some of you may know, there are 613 mitzvot for Jews. And 7 mitzvot for non-Jews. In Hebrew, it's called the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, the 7 Noahide laws of the children of Noah. And, it's interesting because Judaism doesn't believe that everybody has to be Jewish, but it does believe that everybody should be moral. Actually, I saw this quote from Elie Wiesel. He said just this. He said, Judaism doesn't ask the world to be Jewish. It merely asks the world to be good. Which, is a distinction from other religions, some other religions, which believe that if a non-believer, doesn't follow their religion, they're destined for eternal hell. And Judaism does not believe that. Judaism believes that the 613 mitzvot are specifically for Jews. We don't believe that everybody should keep kosher. We believe Jews should keep kosher. We don't believe that everybody should observe Shabbat. We believe that Jews should observe Shabbat, right? Now, there are the 7 Noahide laws, which are an interesting study, but 1 out of the 7 is about creating justice, systems of justice, that a moral society will prosecute criminals. So this is an important aspect of general morality. So that's verse 8. Welcome, Naomi. And here we go, verse 9. Mi yomar zikisi libi taharti mechatasi. Who can say, I have made my heart clean, I am become pure from my sins? So meaning, who can say, who can really, confidently and unequivocally state that they've never done anything wrong? Right? The answer to that is nobody. Nobody, no human being has never made a mistake. Okay? So the importance of justice is not that there should never be a mistake, but rather that mistakes should be dealt with fairly, morally, with justice, right? So that we can live in as good and as moral a society as possible. Okay? So let's go to the commentary. Page 206. Injustice and corruption must prevail in a system of government where each judge deputes authority to a junior colleague in a chain of irresponsibility. Well, that's a statement on society. Okay, I'll read that sentence again. Injustice and corruption must prevail in a system of government where each judge deputes authority to a junior colleague in a chain of irresponsibility. So, and we have, of course, he's not just talking about judges, right? This is applicable to all systems. What is the system that he's describing? Where nobody, or I should say, everybody refuses to take responsibility, always trying to figure out that if it was somebody else's fault, right? Oh, well, that's not my department. That's your department. That's not your department. That's my department. That's not my fault. Somebody else was supposed to take care of that. And so everybody is passing the buck to somebody else, and nobody is willing to step up and say, that was my fault. That was my responsibility. I dropped the ball. I'm going to make it right. When you have a system where everybody's trying to pass off the responsibility to somebody else, that's where you get injustice and corruption. I think I mentioned to you guys a while ago, I was reading a book called Good to Great by Jim Collins. And in it, he studies 11 companies that have seen enormous success, greatness, as he calls it, over a period of 30 years. And in order to, you know, fulfill the ramifications to be included in this 11 company study, you have to outperform your competition. Start out okay, you know, make yourself great, and it had to last for more than 30 years, which means that it would outlast a particular CEO, right? It wasn't about one particular leader, it was about the culture of the company. So, hi Heather and Sydney. So, anyway, then the author and his team of researchers tried to tease out what are the habits of these 11 companies? What factors do they all share in common? And one of them, I believe it's the first one that he mentions, is having a humble CEO. Now, this humbleness manifested in two ways. One way was externally humble, meaning that these CEOs lived in simple homes. They drove simple cars. They got cheap haircuts. They were physically humble. The second aspect was in how they behaved in leadership. And how did he tease that out? Two things. Number one, include everybody else in the credit. And number two, take sole responsibility for the blame. So when somebody says to the CEO, wow, that was amazing. Look what your team did. Look what your company did. The humble CEO would say, oh, it wasn't me. Are you kidding? It was my team. I've got this amazing CFO and look at our employees on the floor. Nobody's better than them. So you share the credit. But when something went wrong, each of these CEOs would inevitably step up and say, that was my fault. I should have seen that. I should have taken responsibility for that. So this is what we're talking about, right? This kind of leadership where you're not passing the buck, where you're not saying, well, that was somebody else's problem. That was somebody else's job. They should have taken care of it. If you're the boss, then you have to clean it up. Okay. So what happens when a judge does this, when everybody's passing the buck? This leaves the poor with no access to appeal to the king or senior judge, since they are at the mercy of petty officials who will not allow any appeals to the higher court. So if your system of society is going to act that way, where everybody in leadership is passing the buck, you know what that means? That means that the vulnerable and disadvantaged members of society are never going to be able to get the help they need, because they can never find anybody who's going to step up and say, yes, me, it's my responsibility, I'll take care of it, right? I'll give you the most minor low-level example. If you go to Trader Joe's and I was so moved by this that I made a video about it on Instagram a while ago. If you go to Trader Joe's and you ask somebody, hey, where can I find the, you know, chocolate chips? They will walk you three aisles down or whatever to the chocolate chips, right? They don't say, oh, it's over there in aisle three. And now it's somebody else's responsibility, or it's your problem if you find it or not. No, it's my responsibility, me, the lowest level employee in the store, to make sure that you find your chocolate chips. It's my job. I'm taking responsibility. So me as the consumer, how do I feel? I feel cared for. I feel noticed. I feel that somebody, it matters to somebody if my needs are met. Right? Now, granted, that's a very first world example. Okay. I'll find chocolate chips eventually. It's not that big of a store. And my self-esteem is pretty good. Like I don't need a Trader Joe's employee to be nice to me to make my day. But this is a systemic issue that we're describing. That's just one example. If you ask somebody for something, whether it's low level or high level, and that person just gives you a cursory brush off, then how are people in need going to get their needs met? The answer is they won't. And that's how injustice and corruption prevails, right? Where the king himself, however, directly supervised the administration of justice, the poor and oppressed have a chance of fair treatment. So what if the king, right, or the highest level of any system says, it's my job to make sure the smallest person has their needs met? Then that's where you're going to get a fair and moral society. There was a rabbi who lived in Israel about 100 years ago. I think his name was Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer, but I'm not completely sure I'm getting the right rabbi. My husband told this story once in the shul on Shabbat. And he was a very, you know, he had a prestigious position, and he was walking with his students on Shabbat afternoon in Jerusalem. And this gentleman comes over to the group, and with a very noticeable stutter, he asks the rabbi for directions. Now, he didn't know that this was a very prestigious rabbi. He thought, you know, everybody in Jerusalem looks like a rabbi. He thought he was just stopping a passerby for, you know, directions. So the rabbi says to him, come here, let me walk you to your destination, right? Maybe this is where the Trader Joe's people learned it from. I don't know. So the guy who asked the directions didn't know this, but the rabbi walked well over an hour each way out of his way in order to bring this man to his destination. And it was Shabbat, so he wasn't going to get into a car or a bus. It was a summer afternoon, and it was very hot. And he took him all the way out of his way. And afterwards, you know, the student said to him, like, Rabbi, you didn't have to do that. Like, you could have just given him directions to the next stop, you know, and then he would have found his way from there. Actually, it's interesting. This is the way many Israelis give directions. If any of you have ever been in Israel and you'll ask an Israeli for directions, the classic, this is like, it's so iconic, it's a joke. The classic response they'll give you is, Yashar, Yashar, Visham Tishali. Go straight, 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 and then ask. That's how they give direction. First of all, nothing is straight in Jerusalem. All the streets are twisty, turny. So it's like, forget it. You never know where you're going. Anyway, so the rabbi says to his students, did you notice that the gentleman had a stutter? So they said, yes. So he said, if I were to tell him, go this far and then ask for directions, it would have been so uncomfortable for him to ask for directions again, because he has a stutter and he's, you can tell that he's uncomfortable asking strangers for directions. So I wanted him to just have to do it once. That, my friends, is leadership. The biggest guy notices the little guy, the littlest guy, and says, that's my job. That's my responsibility. My husband and I are always arguing about this because he's happy to do everything. He'll move the chairs, he'll mop the floor, you know, he'll respond to every email. And I'm like, you have to delegate. You do not have enough time in your day to do all these tasks. I'm like, we have people to do that stuff, you know? And he's like, but it's my privilege. It's my honor to do those jobs, you know? And on the one hand, of course, he's right. And that's what I admire and love so much about him, that there's no job too small for him, you know? But on the other hand, he sort of does need to, you know, triage his time. So anyway, that's what we're talking about. That kind of leadership where you're never too big to respond to the smallest request. This is true on four conditions. Okay, so when we said that the king, when the king himself, however, right, or whoever is in this high level of power, directly supervises the administration of justice, the poor and oppressed have a chance of fair treatment. Okay. Now the author is saying, Malbim is saying, but four things must be true in order for this to be true, meaning that if the king pays attention to the little guy will have a chance for justice. Okay, what are the four conditions that must be met? Number one, that the king holds the reins of justice in his own hands. Sometimes the king is a figurehead, right? Sometimes the king is just being propped up and really he has no actual power. You might be talking to the CEO of the company, but maybe the CEO really has no power. Maybe the CEO is a puppet of someone else. So you have to know who has actual power to make consequential decisions in that system. Number two, that he sits on the throne, right? Connoting constant application to the task. So some people are kings, but they're never actually there. They're always on vacation in, you know, I don't know, Dubai, right? So they're not really hands-on. So they don't really have day-to-day management. Number three, so number one, he has to have the power. Number two, he has to be present. Number three, that he sits in judgment, the Hebrew word being din, and not simply justice, mishpat. What's the difference? The term mishpat denotes the verdict, while din refers to the attentive hearing that people must be given in court to listen to their pleas without the mediation of skilled but possibly distorting advocates. So what does that mean? That means that in order for there to be justice, the king or whoever is in charge of this particular system has to have the power to not just hand down a verdict, but has actually listened to what everybody involved has to say. So you could have a CEO or, you know, the head of patriarch or matriarch of a family or whatever the system might be. And they might have the power to make decisions and say, yes, you're doing this. You're not doing this. We're done with you. We want you to have more power. And that's fine. They may have that power, right? But what about listening? Does that person have the social, emotional, and moral skills to actually hear people out and really listen carefully to what people are saying and not saying, so that by the time they hand down a verdict, they actually have the ability to hand down a moral verdict and not just like, you know, whatever kind of moves them emotionally in that moment or whatever they're already biased towards or against. Okay. So again, there will be justice if the king actually has power, the king is present, the king has actually listened in an unbiased way to all sides. And number four, that in a, which by the way, I'll just back up for a second. You know, in many cases, especially in workplaces and in families, people who have power have very strong biases towards these are my friends, these are my enemies. This one I owe a favor to. This is the one that always takes my side. So I really like them. Right? In order to have this justice, there has to be a freeing oneself of those biases. Number four, that in addition to the actual sessions in court, the king moves about among his people, eradicating evil and corruption wherever he finds it. He scatters away all evil with his eyes. So what does that mean? That means that not only does the king have power, and not only is the king present in his job, and not only is the king listening when people come to him, but that the king has actually moved around about his people. Did you go into the poorest communities and visit with those people and see how they live and see what it feels like to be them, right? Did you, you know, there's an expression, don't judge another person until, you know, you've walked a mile in their shoes, right? So I was researching this quote for my third book, and the original quote was, don't judge another person until you've walked a mile in his moccasins, which I thought that was kind of cute. But how can you really, you know, if you're part of the most elite member of the government, culture, society, family, company, whatever, then do you really know what it's like to be the little guy? Have you ever lived the life of the little guy? Right? Do you remember what it's like to be that guy? That's why politicians are often trying to convince us that they started out with humble roots, because they want us to believe that they have the ability to relate to the little guy. So, right, when we talk about God, there's this expression, especially during Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur season, that the king is in the field, right? That God during that time of year, it's called Yemei Ratzon, the days of desire, that God desires to hear from us. So it's like a king who leaves his palace and leaves the capital city and starts to travel around in all the rural, you know, and outlying areas to see, like, what is life really like for my subjects? You know, and a moral king would even go incognito and go into disguise so people don't know he's the king. So he really feels what it's like to go into that roadside inn and have a simple meal, or for nobody to recognize you, or for you to be an unimportant person. So during Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, the idea is that God is, you know, traveling among us, and he really wants to hear from us, and he really wants to know how we feel. I think I mentioned to you a while ago, there's a rabbi who lives in Atlanta. His name is Rabbi Elon Feldman. His father was the rabbi in Atlanta before him. His name was Rabbi Emanuel Feldman. Excuse me. Actually, the father, Rabbi Emanuel Feldman, he's 96 years old. He lives in Israel. He's a prolific writer. He's still writing. Did I mention to you guys his memoir about the Six-Day War? Somebody at JFX, Esther Shemansky, She wrote, she recommended this book to me. It's called The 12th of Iyar. That was the Hebrew date when the Six-Day War ended. And this rabbi, Emanuel Feldman, this was over 50 years ago. He was then on sabbatical. He was living in Atlanta. He was on sabbatical in Israel. He was living in B'nai Brak, and he was a visiting scholar at Bar-Ilan University, and he was there during the Six-Day War. It's an incredible book. So many chilling parallels to what's going on in Israel right now. I highly recommend it. I'm gonna share the Amazon link on our WhatsApp chat so that you guys can read it. I think it's back in print after having been out of print for a long time. My husband and I both read it and we were like riveted. We couldn't see. He's a beautiful writer in any case, but very special guy. So anyway, his son, Rabbi Ilan Feldman, one time did this experiment. He wanted to feel exactly what we're describing in our verse. Like, what is it like to live like a simple person, right? He's a rabbi. He's the son of a rabbi. He was born into leadership and he wanted to work on his humility. So he had his secretary book him a one-way ticket without telling him where he was going. And he took nothing with him. No money, no credit card, just his ID. And he did not know where he was going until he got to the airport. And he gets on the plane and he wanted to work his way through the country for the sake of working on his humility. And he would go into restaurants and wash dishes and get enough money for his next meal. And that's what he did. I think it was a week. And he writes about his experience. I'm going to dig up the article and share it with you guys because it just goes to show what an exceptional human being he is. But how many people in leadership really do this? Really get down and dirty among the people to see what does it feel like to be a little guy? Very few, right? So those are the four conditions that a king would have the power to restore morality to his kingdom. Under such conditions, few can feel completely confident that such an inexorable judge will find them wholly innocent. Okay, so meaning that if this person, if this leader is really devoted to eradicating evil from his society, right, then everybody better be careful. Right? Who can say so blithely, oh, me, I'm innocent. Really? If we really looked at your books, would you be totally innocent? So when you live in a moral society and people know that the authorities care about eradicating evil, then they're going to watch their back, right? That's where you have these terribly corrupt countries that, you know, are run by these drug cartels. Why? Because everybody knows that the government doesn't care. They're on the payroll too, right? But if people did think that the government cared, they would be a lot more careful. Finally, this is the last paragraph of the commentary. This is, of course, a parable for the King of Kings, who sits constantly on his throne of justice, listening and watching. Hence, no individual can feel confident either of his private thoughts or of his actual deeds, right? That's what it says in verse 9. Who can say, I have made my heart clean? Those are your inner thoughts that nobody can see and hear. I am become pure from my sin. That's your external actions that other people can see. So if you really believe, right, that God is the eternal leader who does all of these four conditions, he does have the power, he is present, he listens to all of us, and he gets down among his people, then it would be a powerful deterrent not to do anything wrong. There was a story of a rabbi. Again, can't remember which rabbi it was. There's a lot of rabbis in my database, sorry. And he was traveling once. This is like, you know, in the 1800s in the shtetl. And he's traveling once with a wagon driver with a horse and buggy. Anyway, they stop alongside the road and the horses need to eat. So the wagon driver takes him to some field. It's not his field, right? And he lets the horses eat in this field. And, you know, the rabbi's thinking to himself, this guy is stealing. He's stealing somebody else's grass. How can I trust somebody who's willing to steal? So he goes over to the wagon driver and he says, someone's watching, someone's watching. So he goes, oh my gosh, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. So he pulls his horses away from the grass and they start traveling again. So as they're traveling again, he says to the rabbi, so who was watching? I didn't see anyone. He says, God was watching. He says, oh, I'm so relieved. I thought you meant a person was watching. So the rabbi says, this guy I cannot trust. You know, oh God, that's nothing. No big deal. I'm scared of people. Again, if we really believe in a system of justice, then when we're tempted to do something wrong behind someone else's back, right, we won't say, oh, nobody's watching, it's just God. Yeah, but God is watching, right? And if that's your system of morality, if enough people have that system of morality, then we would live in a very moral society indeed. Unfortunately, a lot of people are only concerned with people watching and they're not concerned with God watching. Okay, pausing for thoughts, comments, or questions.
Ruthie,
Yeah, Sherry.
do you remember the story? Was it the rabbi who told it about the interview and the guy was sitting in the chair? Heather, do you remember the story? The guy's sitting in the chair and he needed to help, like a bunch of people were organizing the chairs and he was sitting and sitting in the chairs and he got up to help organize the chairs. And then the gentleman came out to say, like, I'm here for the interview. And he's like, well, I'd never talked to anybody. And he said, that was the interview. Wasn't it?
Oh,
Was it the rabbi who taught us that?
I don't remember that story, but I do
Okay.
love it.
Maybe it was Barry. So the bottom line was that he got up to help and, the schlep and help the custodian or whoever was helping with the whatever was going on. And he was all dressed in his suit and he was there to like kibitz, of course, and show his resume and whatever. But he got up to help the people who were moving the chairs around at the shul or the business meeting or whatever it was, the Jewish organization. And he said, that was the interview.
That's
You're
awesome.
willing to help and you're willing to dive in, then you're the guy.
That's great. That's
Hi.
great.
This is Leslie. And
Hi, Leslie.
hi, my son is 29. And when he was, I think, about 5 or 6,
To that effect.
and we have a daughter who's 27. And so, I don't remember exactly what happened, but I think they were fighting, and I think he was not telling me the truth. So I looked at him and I go, Ezra, God will know if you're lying. And he looked at me, he turned kind of white, and he said, I was lying. And to this day, he's been in yeshivas a couple times, 3 times actually, and just kind of takes his Judaism and spirituality very seriously. And he is very ethical and honest. And so I like to credit myself with kind of planting that seed that God is watching.
That's
And
awesome.
you can try to lie, but he's watching. So.
That's great. That's great. I give you credit too. Good job, Mom.
Thank you.
Ruthie,
Hi, Dana.
when we were at your house for Shabbos lunch, we were in the dining room and I asked your husband where the washroom was, and he walked me all the way there. So that really, whatever you said the first part of the story, that class, that was exactly it. And
Yeah.
it totally stayed with me and I loved it and I appreciated it. So he
Oh,
lived it.
thank you for
He walks
sharing
the walk.
that.
That.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you. Hi, Robin. So I have to tell you a funny story about that, Dana. So there is actually a mitzvah. It's part of the mitzvah of hospitality to walk your guests to the door. And a part of that is that your guest shouldn't just feel like it doesn't matter to you that they're leaving, but that they should feel cared for and escorted. Like you want to spend as much time with them as possible, even while they're on their way out.
We learned, oh, sorry. We learned this. We learned that like 15 years ago from a rabbi, Moshe Katz, and he taught us that literally 15 years ago. So it's now a verb in our house. We're like, okay, it's time to Rabbi Katz, and everyone who comes to our house knows that we all Rabbi Katz.
That's great.
And that's we
That's
over.
great.
I love that.
So we one time had a guest for Friday night dinner, and they are not Shabbat observant, and we didn't see a car anywhere. Some people like park down the street, or some people park around the corner. They don't want the car to be in our driveway or right in front of our house. Fine. Anyway, we were walking them out, and it was a beautiful night, and my husband and I are walking them, and they don't live that far. They live like a mile away. And we were just walking and talking and having this great conversation, and we walked them all the way home, and they were like, oh my gosh, you don't have to walk us all the way home. My husband's like, no, it's a mitzvah to escort your guests. Anyway, I think it was literally 5 years later. She tells me when we were much closer, she says, you know, Ruchi, we were parked around the corner and we did not want to say anything to your husband because he was so nice and walking us home. But after you guys left, we turned right around, we walked all the way back, picked up our car and drove it home. But she still remembered how good it felt that we walked her home. Right? So it's such a beautiful lesson, and it's something that we can do, you know, all the time. It's something we can do all the time, is to make the little person feel good when we have the ability to go that extra mile, literally the extra mile. Okay.
It's so funny. Can I ask one more question?
Please.
Is the escorting somebody also have something to do that, like, if somebody dies, God forbid, like on the way home, the like person in charge is responsible? Isn't there something about like this
Yeah.
person? You know what I'm talking
Yeah.
about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually the same word in Hebrew. The word levaya in Hebrew means to escort.
Oh, that's why the Levaya. That
Yep,
makes
that's
sense.
why a funeral in Hebrew is called a levaya, because you're escorting the person who has passed, you're escorting them on their journey to the next world. You're walking them out. And that's why a lot of people don't know this. If you attend a funeral, you should, even if you're not going to the cemetery, if you go to the cemetery, then obviously you're escorting the person to their on their final journey. But if you're not, it is a mitzvah, if it can be done, to walk behind the hearse at least for a few paces, because you're escorting the person on their final journey. So the word, the where it says in the Torah that we should do this for hospitality, to escort a person for hospitality. So the Torah says that Abraham, our patriarch, planted an orchard. And the Talmud explains, and in Hebrew, that word is eshel. That means an orchard. And the Talmud describes, some rabbis say that it was a literal orchard and he used it to feed his guests and to give them shade. Some rabbis say that the word eshel is an acronym. The Aleph stands for achila, which means to feed your guests. The shin stands for shtia, which means drinks. And the lamed stands for levaya, which means to escort. So it's the exact same word, Heather. It's the same mitzvah, really, is to escort a person on a journey.
Thank you for clarifying. That's so awesome.
Yeah. Thank you for making that connection. Okay. Let's do one more verse together. Verse 10. Evan ve'evan, epha ve'epha, toavat Hashem gam shnehem. Diverse weights and diverse measures, both of them alike are an abomination to God. So that means that when a person has different weights, meaning that they are messing with the measurements of, you know, whatever a person does professionally. Let's say that you are a jeweler and you're weighing gold or silver, but your weights are doctored so that you're making more money off of your customers, right? Or measurements, right? Both of them alike are an abomination to God. A person who is dishonest in their business, and weights and measures are just a metaphor. It's not strictly just speaking about that, right? But when a person sort of fudges the numbers, you know, and this is so easy to do. I had an experience the other day. So my first book, Conversations with God, which I published 8 years ago, it's had this total resurgence in sales. I think since October 7th, people are wanting to pray. I was just telling this to Stacey earlier. People who maybe are not used to praying, and they want to buy like a beginner's book on prayer, which is what my book is. Anyway, the book is sold out of all locations, and we did another printing in Israel. They print the book in Israel. So I have stock from the previous run, but right now it's sold out in most bookstores in the United States and on Amazon. So a few
Wow.
people who have wanted to buy books are contacting me privately to buy the books. Just this week, I must have sold like 30 books. So my dilemma is always with shipping. So I do something with media mail. That's when you are shipping just books or other items of media. There's a flat rate, which is much less expensive. And I prefer to ship via media mail because, you know, the customer pays for the shipping, and I would prefer it to be as inexpensive as possible. So if somebody buys two books, right, do I round up the shipping? really the shipping, let's say it's $4.47 to ship a book, you know? So I was saying in my head, well, there's like, you know, what do they call it? Shipping and something and shipping. What's the expression?
Handling
and handling, right? I'm like, I'm the handling. I'm taking from my time to go to the post office and mail the book, you know? But then I'm like, I don't know, Ruchi. Sounds to me like you're inflating your prices and justifying it, you know? I didn't ask a rabbi. I could. I probably should. It's easier for the customer sometimes to just, you know, it's $45 even or $25 even or whatever it is. But I feel like it's at least something that warrants a question to a rabbi. And I know it's only 53 cents. It's not a big deal, but that's not the point. The point is, am I fudging the numbers in my favor? And you can't fudge the numbers in your favor. If anything, I should round it down to make sure that I'm being completely honest, right? It's so easy to do this. And this is what the verse is saying, is that this is an abomination. God hates this behavior. God wants you to be scrupulously honest. Yes, Stacey.
Maybe scrupulously honest, except you end up losing if you don't round up.
Yeah, that's why I need to ask
around. Office, and it's like really, I think it's quite fair.
Okay, well, thank you for your thanks for your rabbinic ruling.
Just a starting point.
Well, and there is usually, like, when we ask our rabbi questions like that, he usually asks us what standard practice in the business, because that matters too, right? If everybody knows this is standard, I'm not talking about something crooked that everybody does, but I'm talking about if this is considered normative business practice, right? Then that would be appropriate. So, okay. So the commentary. Here follows, we're on page 207. Here follows an example of sin in overt action, even when the conscience is clear. In the case of barter, if one has different weights for his commodity in order to cheat, the other too may perhaps use a different measure in repaying him with his wares. So here this person thinks they're gaming the system by fudging the numbers, but maybe the guy you're doing business with is just as crooked as you are, and you're just going to get back what you gave, right? And thus the cheating may balance out. In such a case, the buyer may say, I have made my heart clean. We're going back to the previous verse, right? Who can say I have made my heart clean? Meaning the guy will say, oh, see, I didn't do anything wrong. I cheated him. He cheated me. Let's call it a wash. We're good. But he cannot say, I am become pure from my sin. Maybe you didn't end up gaining financially, but you still acted crookedly, since in fact, he has committed the crime of using discrepant weights, right? And you see this, people using these justifications. So what if I lied to him? She lies to me all the time. Okay, but you still behaved in an immoral way, okay? Or so what if I embarrassed her publicly? She embarrasses me publicly all the time. Okay, so now you've taken revenge. You know, and also it doesn't mean that that person didn't deserve it, but did you have to be the one to dish it out? Let God take care of what that person deserves, right? Like I always say, you don't have to be the instrument of every outcome. Even when both of them, buyer and seller, are alike, page 208, and balance each other out, this is an abomination to God. God still finds this behavior disgusting. So when you find yourself inclined to dish somebody out to something because they do it too, or they've done it to you, or, you know, I've heard people say, like, when they talk about, you know, dishonesty with a big business or with the government, like, well, they owe me because X, Y, and Z, or they'll never notice. Well, that might be true. But here's the real question. Are you proud of your behavior? Would God be proud of your behavior? This behavior is disgusting to God, no matter what the bottom line is. Even if you end up losing money and you're like, see, God, I didn't gain anything. I even lost. Not the point. The point is the morality of your behavior. It's interesting. In this book, this word, Toavat Hashem, the abomination to God, is used many, many times, always talking about honesty and morality. So these are traits that are extremely important for any thinking Jew There is no such thing as being a good Jew and also being morally or financially dishonest. It doesn't go together. It's a contradiction in terms. Now, again, like we always say, it's not all or nothing, right? A person should behave in whatever ways they can behave, even if those behaviors are inconsistent with other behaviors. But some people think that they can compartmentalize. Well, Judaism is about Rosh Hashanah and Passover and, you know, Kiddush and Motzi and Tzedakah. And then I go to work, or then I interact with my family members. And that's its own category. No, it's not. The Torah follows you wherever you go. You can't be one person in the synagogue and a different person in the workplace. That's not what Judaism teaches, right? We want to be like a pure through and through, that our values carry us through everything that we do. There is no compartmentalizing in Judaism. It all goes together. Okay. Any final thoughts, comments, or questions? Okay, I will make one final comment. You know, sometimes it can be very frustrating when you do find yourself in a system where most people are acting, let's call it immoral, right? Whether, again, it's a workplace or a family system or whatever it may be. And you just really feel tempted to sort of stoop to the culture of the system because everybody else is doing it. And I just want to give you a moment of encouragement that, like, the ability to rise above that temptation and to say that above all, I want to be able to assert, like, exactly what it says in verse nine, who can say I have made my heart clean? I have become pure from my sins. That you should really be able to feel when you go to bed at night, I am proud of the person I was today. And I didn't stoop to the lowest common denominator. It's so worth it. And again, God will take care of the issues. You don't need to worry about that. It's not your mess to clean up. Robin.
So I am really glad that I got on here. I only had 15 minutes, but I was on a bus and I was like, I'm going to get on. And I was very tempted to do something that I knew was wrong. It wasn't really going to hurt anybody other than a company. And my justification was they've been very anti-Israel. So I had a full-on discussion in my mind. I couldn't pull the trigger, but I was like, this is fine because they're not supporting Israel. So I'm really happy that I got on because I did not do what would have been wrong. So, you know, once again,
that is providential.
Feel like they're for me.
Wow, that's kind of unbelievable. Like literally what you were dealing with and you only came on for those 15 minutes.
Yeah, and it was just this morning and I decided, you know, all bets are off because this has to do with Israel and Jews.
Wow.
And so yeah.
That's HP.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that.
Robin, I'm so proud of you. That's huge. Thank you. I'm glad I didn't do it actually. I would have felt horrible. But yeah.
I agree with Heather. Very cool.
Thank
you. Okay. Any final thoughts before we close off?
Mm-hmm. It reminds me, Rocky, yeah. Sorry. One more story. And maybe you can tell it because I don't remember exactly. But when the man was davening and someone wanted to like buy something from him and in his mind, he agreed to the initial price. There's like that story, and then the one about purchasing maybe like a donkey, and then there was like a diamond or something in the satchel.
Yeah.
You know,
Those are two great points about honesty. So one of them is, this is in the book Orchos Tzaddikim, The Ways of the Righteous, that the truly like righteous people, when they were doing business, if they had a certain price in their head, they would only sell it for the initial price, even if the person offered more. So this one guy was in the middle of praying and this guy made him an offer and he didn't answer because he was in the middle of praying. So the guy thought he didn't answer because he didn't like the price. So he offered a higher price and then a higher price. And finally, when he was done praying, he said, I'm going to give you the first price that you offered.
She likes the brown sauce. Sorry.
Because even though I couldn't respond to you. But in my head, I had accepted the first price. And so he wanted to have that level of integrity that he didn't want to cheat him because he, you know, because he had thought that he wasn't accepting the price when he was. And then the second story that Heather mentioned was about, there was this rabbi, his name was Shimon ben Shetach, who lived in Talmudic times, and he was very poor, and his students decided to buy him a donkey, and they bring back the donkey so that he could like rent out the donkey and make some money. They brought back the donkey, and there was a little bag around the donkey's neck, and in it they discovered a diamond. And the rabbi said, you need to take the donkey back. And they said, why? It was the owner's mistake. You're not legally obligated to take it back. You're not obligated. This is true of American law too, by the way. If the seller makes a mistake, you're not legally obligated to get back to him and say, hey, it's your diamond, right? But he said, listen, he said, I bought a donkey. I didn't buy a diamond. It's not right. It doesn't matter if I could get away with it, or it doesn't even matter if it's technically legal. Like, that's not the person I want to be. So his students bring back the donkey and they tell the owner what happened, and they show him the diamond. And he said, blessed is the God of Shimon ben Shetach, which is the literal definition of a Kiddush Hashem, of sanctifying God's name. That when a Jew behaves with honesty and integrity, that it reflects well on the Jewish people and on Jews and on Judaism and on God, right? So that's a great story, Heather. Thank you, to close up our class today.
Thank you, Rookie. I hope you have a really meaningful rest of your fast.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. Have a wonderful Shabbat and a wonderful
Good Purim. Shabbos.
Good Shabbos. From Sameach.
See you back here next week.
Good Shabbos, everyone.
Bye.
Bye. Good Shabbos.